Well, man, it's been a while.
It's been a long while. We've missed you.
My name is Patrick. So we were out 1 week that was planned and came back. It was funny. Our family, and then Katie's two sisters and each of their families all went out to go see Grandma in Colorado and all crashed at her house. And she's 97 and a half. And so we thought, we need to make sure that we don't get this woman sick. Let's all take COVID tests before we go. We all took COVID tests. We were all negative. We got there. Grandma was positive and infected the rest of us. Oh. So we came back a little under the weather, and I was saying I felt okay last week. I probably could have preached, but I probably also would have gotten other people sick. It was probably still contagious, so I think it was the right call to just stay home and attend online. But what that means for us is that it's been 3 weeks since we've talked about the theology of the city. And I don't know if y'all remember what cities are, so we may have to do a little more review than I was hoping, but we will power through and we'll refresh ourselves. And the hope for today is not to do anything, any kind of deep dive into one text. The hope is that we're going to move quickly from Genesis to Revelation and try to get a broad view of the story of the city as told by the Bible. Sound good? That's the plan. All right. So let's pray, and then we will dive in. Father, you are full of grace and mercy, and you are just relentlessly patient with us. And I am so thankful. And I'm thankful for the gift of your church, for other people who share in the fellowship of your spirit, that we can come together and to think about your word and to be shaped by your word. And as we're doing that this morning, I pray that you would help us to think biblically and to think critically and to think in a more well-rounded way about what a city is and where it came from, where it's going, so that we can engage our community in a way that that honors your word. Father, we lift up this prayer to you in the name of our Lord Jesus. Amen. Okay, I don't have a slide for a review. I think most people have a handout. If you don't have a handout but you want one, Paul's handing them out. You can just raise your hand. He'll get you one. I don't have a slide for review, but 3 weeks ago, the last time we were here, we talked about the four pillars of the city. Does anybody remember what any of those four pillars are? Okay. That's good. This tells me what I needed to know. A city is multiple families, community, kinship. You can't have just one family group. You got to have multiple family groups living together. So community is one. They have a common government, so they can't. Each family can't be a law unto themselves. They have to have a shared set of expectations. You have to have specialization of labor. If everybody is in food production, it's not a city. You have to have at least some people who are doing something other than producing food. So you have to have industry, and then in order to sustain the people who aren't food producers, you have to produce more than enough food. So part of a city is, what do you do with the surplus food? How do you manage surplus food? And that gets us into economics. So economy, industry, community, and government are the four pillars that we are going to be using through the series. So we're going to look at the story of the city. You guys ready? We're going to go kind of quick. So here we go. Oh no, they don't pop up one at a time. That's fine. So from Eden to Enoch. To state the obvious, Eden is not a city. I don't know if that ever occurred to you. But Why do we know it's not a city? How many family groups are there? Many or just one? Just one. Do you have anybody working outside of food production? No. You don't have an economy. You don't have industry. You do have more than enough food, but you don't have a system of food management and distribution. So you don't have economy. And then humans are meant to be rulers over creation. When God creates the humans in Genesis 1, he tells them to be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the creatures of the earth. Humans are meant to be rulers, but not rulers over each other. You don't see human kings over other humans in Eden. So Eden is not a city. The temptation, which ultimately drives the humans out of the garden, is the temptation to be like God. So in Genesis 3, verses 4 and 5, "You will not surely die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." What is it about the tree that's alluring to her is that the tree is a way for her to be like God. Now, why is that ironic? Well, her desire to be like God doesn't work out, to say the least. When God formed humans, what did he say? We're made in his image. The humans are already like God. And so this is, we're like God in some ways, but we're not like God in other ways. And so the tree represents this possibility to become like God in ways that are sort of off limits to us. And specifically, it is the tree of what? It's not the tree of good and evil. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The tree of the knowledge. The word knowledge is very common in the book of Proverbs for discernment, determining whether something is good or not good. So I don't think it's that if they eat, then they're all of a sudden going to have a conscience. It's that in eating, they are determining for themselves what is good and what's evil. They're seizing the power to define right and wrong for themselves. And when humans define for ourselves what's right and wrong, do things go well or not well? Not well. And that's a huge rabbit trail that we're not going to follow. But the temptation which drives the humans from the garden is we want to be like God. We want to be the shot callers. And so the sin which drives the humans from the garden is an act of pride. Think about this. What drives humans out of the non-urban garden is the desire to be the shot caller, to be like God. Because when you're in the garden, you're like God. But when you're outside the garden, you're not like God. The next story. Does anybody remember what the next story is immediately after the Garden of Eden? Cain and Abel. Okay. Cain kills his brother over worship. He's not going to be the last person in history, by the way, who kills his brother because of worship. And then, in chapter 4 of Genesis, verse 8. "Now Cain said to his brother Abel, 'Let's go out to the field.' And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Where's your brother Abel?' 'I don't know,' he replied. 'Am I my brother's keeper?' The Lord said, 'What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth.'" Okay, what is Cain going to have to do to survive? He's going to have to work, but he can't farm anymore because whatever he plants, it's not going to grow. So he has to forage, right? He's going to have to spend his life foraging. And if he's going to forage, what is he also going to have to do? He's going to have to keep moving. He's going to be a restless wanderer on the earth. Okay. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." So now he's worried that what he did is now going to happen to him. But the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, he will suffer vengeance seven times over." But then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. Okay, now I realize there's like a ton of questions surrounding this. Who are these people he's afraid of? Where did his wife come from? Okay, we're not going to go down that road. The point is that Cain builds a city. Why?
He can't be a farmer anymore.
He can't be a farmer. So he can't be in, well, you know, he can't be in food production. But what is it that drives him to build this walled-in place?
His sin.
His sin and his fear. Right? He's afraid that people are going to hurt him. The city is a place of refuge for him. It's a place for him to hide and protect himself. So what do we learn about the city just based on this story? Well, for one, it's still not quite a city as we've defined it. The text uses the word city, but as we've defined it, you don't have multiple families, you don't have economy, you don't have government, but the text uses the word. The city is a human invention. It's not a divine invention. God didn't tell Cain to go build a city. In fact, God told him he was going to wander. And for him to put down roots and say, "I'm going to live here and not wander," is in some ways kind of a rebellion against the command of God. So the city is a human invention. I think that's going to be really important as we continue on. The city is also a movement away from the Eden ideal. The city is a fortress. It's a way of protecting yourself from human predators, which is going to be really ironic because the city is also
breeds predators.
Yeah, full of violence. So when you leave Eden and move into the city, well, maybe what I'm saying is leaving Eden is a movement into the city. Moving into the city is moving away from Eden. All right, how are we doing so far? We've made it through the first four chapters. Got a little over 1,000 chapters to go. My throat gets raw easily. So if I wind up kind of coughing a little bit, it's just because my throat is really dry.
How's your head?
Man, my neck.
And your headache.
Headache has been okay. I pulled a muscle in the back of my neck and trying to like check my blind spot like this, I wind up swerving into oncoming traffic. But I'm fine so far. I'm here. Okay, any questions on any of this?
What happened to Cain's pride? If he had so much pride, he moves to the city and built a wall around him. What happened to his pride?
Where did his pride go? What do you think?
A person that has all this pride wouldn't build something around him with fear.
Yeah, I think pride and the city are going to go hand in hand. But we don't know anything else about Cain. After this, he builds a city, names it after his son, and then we don't hear from Cain again until like 1 John or something. So we don't know. Beyond what we just read. But I'm glad that you're noticing the connection between pride and the city. Okay, so Act 2. So after the invention of the city, we see the emergence of human culture and we see the emergence of violence. So if you're in Genesis 4, look down at verse 19. So we just had Cain built a city. He had his son Enoch. Enoch had his son. He had his son. He had his son. All the way down to Lamech. Lamech married two women, one named Adah and the other Zillah. Adah gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. You got to think that they're twins. Jabal and Jubal, come on. He was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal's sister was Naamah. And Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. So we see here just the seedlings of culture beginning to sprout. We have people who are starting to fashion things out of iron. We have the invention of music. But we also have the rise of violence. You have, for the first time, a man who is collecting women like cattle. And he's bragging about how he is more vengeful and violent than Cain ever was. And he says, if Cain is avenged 70 times, then Lamech is going to avenge himself how many times? 77. Does that number make you think of anything else in the Bible? Oh, yeah, something about forgiveness. Forgiving. How many times should I forgive my brother? Up to seven times? No. 77 times. You should be as zealous for forgiveness as Lamech is for violence. I think that's... We don't have time to go there. That's really interesting. Okay. Where am I? Chapter 6. We're just going to skip over the genealogy. Chapter 6, verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people of the earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. So the movement out of Eden and into the city brings with it the emergence of culture, but also the emergence of violence. And when we talk about the flood, my experience has been we tend to say, well, humans were so sinful. And it's just kind of this generic sin problem. But the Bible is actually more explicit than that. The Bible says the problem is violence. Humans hurting other humans. And it's because of that that God cleanses the earth with the flood. Following the flood, we read about the rise of the first great city of the Bible in chapter 11. So if you're following, you can turn to chapter 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. And they said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. And then they said, come, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city, and that was why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So when Noah and crew land and the waters recede, part of what God tells Noah about this kind of rebirth of the world is that they are to fill out and subdue the earth. He actually says the same thing he says in Genesis 1. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. But the people who come from Noah, do they spread out, fill the earth and subdue it? No. They cloister together. And they find a spot where they can put down roots and we're all going to be right here. And it's an act of rebellion. It's an act of rebellion. They build a city. And of course, the iconic feature of the city is the famous Tower of Babel, right? And why is it that they want to build the tower? Yeah, they want to get to heaven. It's supposed to have its top up where the gods are, so that you can just walk. People think it's a spiral, because we have a couple of examples, I think, of this sort of spirally ziggurat type tower. So they're gonna, if they climb to the top of this tower, then they'll be up where the gods live, and so we'll make a name for ourselves. They're making a name for themselves. That is, again, pride, right? It is pride, the desire to be more than we are, that funds and fuels the growth of the city. The city is an attempt to return to Eden. Because Eden is on the top of a mountain. You guys realize that? Ezekiel says that. He says that, I wish I had the chapter and verse on me, that Eden, the garden of God, is the mountain of God. It's this place up, it's a high place where God's space and human space kind of overlap. And humans are now trying to build their own mountain so that they can get back into God's space. It's an attempt to return to Eden. Does that make sense? That probably makes more sense to me because I've thought about this before, but maybe this is new to you. But this is really important. In building Babel, in building the tower, they're trying to reconstruct Eden and enter it on their own terms.
The pagan gods were always at the top of the mountain. That's where they dwelled.
The pagan gods were always at the top of the mountain. Yeah, you think in Greek mythology you have Mount Olympus. Even if all you've seen is the Disney's Hercules movie, you've heard of Mount Olympus. Baal lives on top of a mountain. Even Yahweh lives on top of a mountain. In Jerusalem, right? That's where his temple is. Okay. Let me get back to my notes here. There's something to be said about this, that cities, including Dallas and Fort Worth, are an attempt to return to Eden. It is humans working together to try and create a divine experience where everybody has what they need and everything is fair. They're trying to make sure that there's enough food. The problem is it never works out. This is a deep irony in the city. It is trying to be Eden on its own terms. So how does God feel about cities? We're 11 chapters in now. Had a couple of cities. What do you think? God excited about cities or not excited?
Not.
He's not. He's not excited. So in the beginning of the Bible, the first book and a half, first five books or so, God is in the business of calling people out of the city and calling them to be wanderers instead. So Cain is not told to build a city. He's told that he's going to be a wanderer. And so his city building is sort of a rejection of this fact that he's going to have to wander. God sees that Babel is dangerous. And so he puts the kibosh on it and he scatters the people away from the city. Abraham. Where is Abraham when God first calls him? Does anybody remember? He is in Ur of the Chaldees. He's in Ur, the city of Ur. It's the capital of the Sumerian Empire. He's called out of the city, and once he's called out of the city, when does Abraham start living in a city again?
Does he ever?
Never. Never. He's a wanderer for the rest of his life. All of the patriarchs live outside the city. Isaac does, Jacob does, even Esau lives outside the city. And by the time we get to Exodus, we find that Abraham's family is living in a city. And why are they now living in a city in Exodus? What brought them there?
Famine.
Hmm? Famine. There's a multitude of factors working together. Famine is a big one. How about Joseph? How did Joseph get to the city?
Slavery.
He's sold as a slave. He's sold by his brothers. And then the severe famine strikes. There's no surplus food. And so in order to survive, Abraham's family has to go and live in the city. So again, the city is a place of refuge. But it's also a place that's full of violence. So I'm going to skip now to Exodus chapter 1. Verse 8. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as what? Is anybody reading it? Store cities for Pharaoh. What do you suppose they're storing in these store cities? Cookies? Did somebody say cookies? It's a COVID hearing. Food. They're storing food. So they are enslaved, not building pyramids. They're enslaved building cities. That's interesting. And not just any city, but they're cities that are somebody else's empire. They are enslaved building places for extra food to be kept. Do you suppose the Israelites themselves have extra food? No. No, the city is getting out of control. And so God, because he's in this business, he calls the people out of the city to be wanderers instead. Under the leadership of who? Moses. Now, Moses, where does he start? Does he start in the wilderness or does he start in the city? He starts in the city, and then he's in the wilderness, and then God has him go back to the city and bring the people out of the city into the wilderness. God is in the business of getting people out of the city and into the wild.
Is he still in that business today?
Ask me again at the end. Because it's not a simple yes or no. Why? Why is God calling people out of the wilderness or out into the wilderness? It's because the wilderness is a place where God teaches people how to live. The alternative to the city is not the small town. The alternative to the city is not the small town. The alternative to the city is the wild. And God uses the wilderness to teach humans how to live. This is where they get legislation on community life, family relationships, sexuality, treating your neighbor fairly, economic practices like taxation, fair trade, tithing, charging interest, doing business, even industry and government. By industry, We're just thinking about jobs that aren't food production. And there are precious few jobs in the wilderness that are not food production. Precious few. And they're largely religious or government. As far as I can tell, those are the only two jobs. But God holds out this ideal that Israel is never going to have a king. That he will be their king. They're not going to need human government. But he also recognizes what he's working with. And so he legislates on the king, what the king is allowed to do. At the end of Israel's time in the wilderness, Moses explains the purpose of their time in the wilderness in Deuteronomy 8. Remember, they're standing, they've gone through 40 years in the wilderness, they've been learning all this stuff, and then they stand at the banks of the Jordan, they're about to cross over, and Moses says this, Deuteronomy 8, verse 2. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. To humble you. The purpose of the wilderness was to humble you. What? Why are cities built? Do you remember? Why did Babel get built? Pride. And the wilderness teaches you humility. Okay. That's phase two. Any questions? Thoughts? Insults? Challenges? Okay. If you think of one, let me know. At this point, are cities good or bad?
Bad.
Right now, they're bad. They're human inventions built out of pride. They're an attempt to go back to Eden, which is forbidden, and to do it on our own terms. And so God is calling people out of the city into the wilderness, starting all the way with Cain. Because it's only outside the city that we can learn to be the humans that God wants us to be. And so we're surprised that God selects a city to put his name in. So now I've got to... Oh, I got to flip over to 1 Kings here. 1 Kings chapter 11. Verse 35. Okay, so the nation of Israel has been solidified under David. Saul was never able to get all the 12 tribes to really work together, but David does, and he makes Jerusalem the capital. And then Solomon, his son, becomes the next king, and he imposes an unbelievable amount of taxation on the people. He enslaves his own people in order to build his temple and his palace. Everybody hates Solomon, and when his son becomes King Rehoboam, they come to Rehoboam and they say, you got to give us a break on taxes. And Rehoboam listens to the older folks, and then he listens to the younger folks, and he decides to listen instead just to what the younger folks say. And he says, my father scourged you with whips, and I'm going to scourge you with scorpions. I'm going to raise taxes. He's trying to flex on his own people, and instead civil war breaks out. The nation splits in half. Okay. And then we come to this. This must be a prophecy from someone. Okay, so a prophet is speaking to the king that's emerging in the northern kingdom. In verse 35, I will take the kingdom from his son's hands, Solomon's son's hands, and I will give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son, so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. God's presence and his name is somehow attached to the city. And that's surprising because cities so far have not been good things. So far they have been basically exclusively wicked. But God is going to have this unique relationship with Jerusalem. He doesn't build Jerusalem. He doesn't order Jerusalem to be built. What he does is he takes a city that's already functioning as the capital and he chooses to put his name there, which raises the possibility that maybe God can use cities despite the fact that they are wicked and human inventions. maybe the city is not irredeemable. Maybe God can do something with the city. So he puts his name into Jerusalem. How does this go? Is Jerusalem awesome or not awesome? There's a little bit of both, but on the whole, not good. It goes not well. Jerusalem becomes corrupt, even though God's name is there. We could look at different prophecies. We could look at what Micah has to say about Jerusalem or Zephaniah. I've been in my own study. I've been going through Isaiah. Haven't gotten very far, but going through Isaiah. Isaiah doesn't have a real high opinion of Jerusalem either. Jeremiah, we looked at in the spring. Jeremiah is not fond of the city. Jerusalem has become corrupt. Jerusalem has not humbled itself. It continues to struggle with pride like any other city. And so when Jerusalem falls in 586, when it's conquered by the Babylonians, what also falls is the hope of redeeming the city. Maybe the wilderness is the only way of living. Psalm 106. Verse 34. They did not, this is remembering the cycle of the judges, which we didn't talk about. They did not destroy the peoples as the Lord had commanded them, but they mingled with the nations. Am I reading the right thing? Oh, this is just a really long section. I'm not going to read this whole thing. Psalm 106, verse 34 to 46. You're welcome to read it on your own. But the poet is remembering the cycle of the book of Judges, how the people are good, they love and they honor God, and then they turn away from him, and then things go badly for them. They're conquered or they're taxed out their eyeballs or whatever, and then they cry out and God raises up a deliverer and they're saved and they have a good relationship with God, and then they turn away from him, and it's this whole cycle repeats over and over. Psalm 106 is remembering this cycle, and then you look at how the poem ends in verse 47. Save us, O God, O Lord our God, and gather us from the nations. The poet sees that the same cycle from the judges has played itself out with Jerusalem. Jerusalem turned away from God, and so it fell. It was conquered by Babylon. And they know from the cycle of judges the way back is to cry out to God. And it's saying, save us. Bring us back from all the places where we've been scattered. Jerusalem represents possibility that God can do something good with the city. But it also represents the very worst that humanity has to offer. We see this in the life of Jesus when Jesus submits himself to Jerusalem's pride and violence and injustice. And he allows himself to be killed. And he doesn't do it in Galilee. He doesn't do it in Egypt. Where else could it be done but Jerusalem? Is there any hope for the city? Okay, how are we doing? We got one more act. Okay, well, let's get through the other act, and then I'm sure you'll have just a myriad of questions. Revelation, very end of the Bible, last page. Not the last page, it's right before maps. No, that was a joke. This. Okay. All right. Revelation 21, very end. Okay, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and will be their God. The New Jerusalem which is this vision that John has of sort of the end of history. What he sees is a city coming out of heaven that's established on the earth. People are going to live there. God lives there. And what it is it's a blend of Eden and the city. The Garden of Eden and the city. So in chapter 22, the angel showed me the river of the water of life flowing from the throne of God. Eden. Is there anything to do with Eden and rivers? Do those go together? Yes. Yes. Eden has a river flowing out of it. It says that it, once it leaves the garden, it splits into four headwaters and it becomes the four great rivers of the earth. It waters the... All of life is watered by Eden. That's the point in Genesis 2. And now here in the New Jerusalem, we see the river of the water of life. We also see the tree of life, which we haven't heard from since Eden. Actually, we pick it up in Proverbs because wisdom is the tree of life. But we're not going to go down that road. You have these different images popping up from Genesis. Even the precious metals, when it's describing the four great rivers, it says one of them flows through Havilah. There's much gold there and onyx and bdellium and all these great, these precious metals. And in the New Jerusalem, those metals are there, but they're no longer like raw and in the earth, but they've been taken and shaped and turned into something. They've been developed. And of course, you have God and people together again. The New Jerusalem is this redeemed vision of the city by somehow weaving together this wicked human invention with God's original purpose. In the New World, God does not erase human innovation as though it never happened, but he weaves it into his divine purposes. When all of history comes to an end and the Bible is envisioning what will the world be like when Jesus returns, it's not a city-free environment. It's not wilderness. It's the city. So God's ultimate dream for the city is not that it would disappear, but that it would be redeemed. So the question is, what does it take for a city to be redeemed? Takes a change of the people.
Turning back to God.
So, turning back to God? In what ways?
Always.
In solid all. Answer. Always.
Yeah. Well, in all of our lives.
Okay. Think about what Moses said at the banks of the Jordan, what the people learned in the wilderness. What does the city have to learn? Humility. You have to learn humility. Think about the law. We have to learn how to treat each other well. You think about Isaiah or Jeremiah or any of the prophets who say, oh, the city has become so corrupt. What needs to happen? Like fair economic practice, fair industry, and ultimately a government where God is king. We have to be able to surrender power. Okay. So, thoughts, comments, rude remarks. Yes, sir.
Sitting in Bill's chair, so I'll ask a question.
Right. You got to ask it real slow.
Okay. Well, one of the things that the theme of wandering that God intended for his people to wander is also kind of tied to the fact that when David felt bad because he was living in a house of cedar, he wanted to build a temple for God, and God's response was, when have I ever asked you for that? Yeah. I intended to stay in a tent, to go wherever we go. Mm-hmm. And God did kind of what you're talking about here. He made an adjustment, and he wove the human side of it into it. He allowed Solomon to build that. But God's intention was still tied to wandering because of what it been out of benefits his people. They have to trust him. Thought that was an interesting kind of connection between those two.
Yeah, I love that.
By the way, Bill is not here. He fell out.
Oh, no.
When they were getting in the car and had a spell, and she said that right now he's back in bed, but she'll take him to the hospital if she needs to. But okay. Mike had to help him get him back in the house, so that's why they're not here.
Okay.
Well, the cities must be a good thing, too, because you didn't see none but John preaching from the wilderness, because the preacher didn't go to one person here and one person here. Paul went to the cities to preach, because
yep.
That's where the mass of people is.
Yeah, Paul's strategy is to go from one city to the next preaching about Jesus. But John the Baptist's strategy is to stay out in the wilderness, and all of Jerusalem comes out of the city to the wilderness to hear him.